Hey, welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema with me, your host, Jimmy Bernasconi on 2XXFM People Powered Radio. On today's show, we're going to be focusing on loving powerful women. Yeah, so you are a powerful woman? Are you in love? Maybe you're in love with a powerful woman. How could you not be? Yes, this week we're talking about films that have a prominent female character at the center of them that is, quite prestigious, that possesses a bit of authority, or maybe they don't. Maybe it's only skin deep. Maybe they only seem to possess a great deal of power. Why are we talking about loving powerful women? Well, as I mentioned last week, I've been increasingly interested in love, romantic films generally, and I wanted to break it up a little bit. Last week we talked about Young Love, and we had a look at a couple of stories that were a bit grim, focused on some women who were in pretty low socioeconomic situations. They're a bit young, a little bit naive, and I thought, well, why don't we flip it around? Why don't we tell the stories or discuss the stories of women who perhaps have a little bit more power, a little bit more authority, and sort of discuss, how do they navigate relationships? How do they go about falling in love? With whom do they fall in love? Who falls in love with them? Why does that happen? Who do they seek? Who generally seeks them? What does the culture, what does the history of cinema suggest about that sort of thing? So if you are a big fan of the show, this one is a little bit of a throwback, I suppose. A couple of weeks ago we talked about Beauties and Beasts and the idea of engaging that more animalistic, or perhaps that more intuitive or organic, or that aggressive side of femininity, and integrating that into your day-to-day, integrating that into your personality, and seeing, you know, what are the implications of that sort of thing. And I think with a lot of the characters in these films, they are sort of a little bit more fancy or hoity-toity. We talked a lot about civility in that week, and they're trying to break free of those shackles. Certainly in the first film we're going to talk about, that's definitely getting into that sort of territory, you know, getting well acquainted, becoming familiar with the commoners as opposed to the other high society types. So I would recommend going back and having a listen to that one as well. But then also, if we're talking about powerful women in relationships, or powerful people generally in relationships, I think it's also worth mentioning that we did talk about, I believe it was the second episode we ever did, power and relationships, and the idea of, you know, at what point does power play a role in a relationship? Can you have a relationship between two people who aren't equals? At what point does power become exploitation or domination or that sort of thing? And I think when we talked about that week, we did focus on Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I think got a bit of a run, but that was more to sort of suggest an alternative where you have a relationship that doesn't have conflict, or at least doesn't have a power imbalance. The other two were The Piano and Phantom Thread, where I believe that the character in those examples that has more of the power is a male figure there. So maybe this one is the maybe this week's episode is a nice bookend to that, or another version of that episode, which focuses more on relationships in which the woman has more of the power. I'm speaking obviously about a heterosexual relationship in that sense. Before we get stuck into the films, we always like to have a look at how has this been depicted in the culture throughout history, throughout literary history, or perhaps in the major religions, or in cultures and things like that. Well, I think if we go back to the ancient Greek, as we'd love to do, it happened quite a bit that the gods and the goddesses would fall in love with the mortals. Right? So you've got an inherent power imbalance there. We've got, you know, a divine figure falling in love with a mere human being. One that springs to mind, a favorite of mine, is the story of Selene and Endymion. If you are a big fan of Greek mythology, you would know that Selene is the goddess of the moon. She rode that chariot of the moon across the night sky, and one evening she spotted this young, golden-haired, absolute spunk out in a sheep paddock, and his name was Endymion. And she said to Zeus, she said, look, this guy, he's a very sexy boy. I'm in love with him. Can you, by any chance, can you put him to sleep for me? And I can just go down there and make love with him whenever I so choose and have many, many children. And of course, that was granted by Zeus, big fan of that sort of thing. So the idea of spying upon someone who's perhaps not your equal and having a deep desire for them is something that has been sort of explored in mythology and things like that before. So let's see what the films of more recent stories that have been depicted on the silver screen, what do they have to say about this sort of dynamic between more powerful ladies and I guess in all these examples are heterosexual relationships. We should mention that up front. What do they have to say? Well, let's firstly establish what the films are going to be. The first one is going to be the William Wyler film from 1953. That would be Roman Holiday, starring Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck. Of course, in that case, Audrey plays a princess, Princess Anne. We're then going to move on to a French film from 1988, directed by Claire Denis. And that would be Chocolat, not to be confused with the Lasse Hallström film starring, I think it's Juliette Binoche and Johnny Depp. And then we're going to finish off with a favorite of everyone's, and that would be Roger Michel's 1999, as far as rom-coms go, this might be at the top of the list. That would be Notting Hill, of course, starring Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts. But let's get started with our first film for today's discussion. That would be Roman Holiday. So if you're not quite familiar with this one, Audrey Hepburn plays Princess Anne. And she is, she's the princess of an unnamed European nation. It's not really important that she is the prince. It's not really important what country she rules. She's just a princess. And she's in Rome for a couple of days on some kind of diplomatic excursion. She's meeting all these other world leaders. And as you could expect, you know, she's young. She's always under the pressure of, holding up or maintaining a very regal stance and presenting herself as a princess and everything like that. But she just wants to cut loose and break free of the hotel and see Rome for what it really is. And she goes out one night and has a few too many and meets Gregory Peck's character. He plays Joe Bradley, and unknown to Anne, he's actually a journalist. He's a writer who's trying to get back to New York, and he can see that if he can get to know Anne, he's got a hot story to give back to his boss, and that'll lead to a lot of moolah in his pockets. So these two, they go out into Rome. They don't tell anybody, don't tell any of the officials. And they see Rome for what it really is. And I think the first thing that I wanted to mention is the fact that I think it's really important that this film is actually... It's important to know that this film is set in Rome, of all cities in Europe, or of all cities in the world. I mean, they don't just sort of run around and eat pizza and eat gelato, even though that does happen at one point. A big part of it is actually engaging with a lot of the architecture, a lot of the sculptures and that sort of thing. I think that often does happen in cinema. You do get to lift up these ideas of very classical ideas and try and create a link between the characters we're seeing, who are modern day characters, at least when the film came out, were modern day characters, with these old heroes and titans and gods and goddesses of yesteryear. We see a lot of very profound architecture and sculptures and things like that, which I think lifts up this idea of the origins of the West, or the origins of the conventions, or the origins of the institutions that are being sort of questioned or played around with in the film. So it's an interesting setting for the film to be based in. But the main part of this film that I wanted to get into is how I think it can be really helpful or really useful to view this sort of as a modern fairy tale, which is sort of depicting, what does the modern princess desire? What does, and we're talking about 1953 here, right? So, women's husbands have come home from war, they're settling, but we haven't quite got to the women's lib movement yet. There are a lot of questions being raised. What does the high society woman desire? What does she really want? And I think there's quite a bit of intertextuality in this film, whether it's intended or not. I mean, some of it is quite obvious, but I think there's two main princesses various fairy tales that are referred to throughout this film. The first one, I think there's a bit of a Sleeping Beauty vibe to it. Not only because she is this princess who's being locked away and told that, you know, she can't go out anywhere and prick her finger, which is obviously what happens in Sleeping Beauty. But when we first, well, went, sorry, when Mr. Bradley first meets Princess Anne, she's fallen asleep from drinking too much, and he's carrying around her sleepy body, and she keeps wanting to fall asleep. And there's this funny scene where she's trying to get into sleep in his bed rather than sleeping on his couch and that sort of thing. So I think we're getting these ideas of Sleeping Beauty, but the use of that is that it's lifting up these ideas of that she's been sheltered her entire life, and that's of course a cautionary tale about doing so and not engaging with the real world, not engaging with the commoners, not engaging with other people at the street level. So of course that's harking back a little bit to what we talked about in the Beauties and the Beast episode a couple of weeks ago. But building on that, I think this film also refers a bit to Cinderella as well. And I think you might say to that, well, how could it be referring to both? They're not really about the same thing. They have a different moral, or at least, the character dynamics are quite different in Sleeping Beauty. The princess is, she's a princess, whereas in Cinderella, she's a commoner. Well, I think that Roman Holiday is sort of like the inverted version of Cinderella, which I think it says a lot about modern power. In European folklore, I suppose little girls did want to grow up and be princesses, but maybe this film is getting at something that's a little bit new or a bit refreshing in 1953. So in Cinderella, we've got this idea that Cinderella's there and she's scrubbing away at the toilets or the floor of that house that she lives in or whatever, and then she gets her big break where she can spend, 24 hours or 12 hours as a princess and then go back to her life as a commoner. Well, in Roman Holiday, we get the complete opposite. Princess Anne is a princess for most of her life, and then she gets this quick chance, this quick period of 24 hours where she gets to be a normal person, you know, hanging around the marketplace and running around the streets and riding scooters and that sort of thing. So if we import some of the morality or the lessons from Cinderella into this film, it's almost to say that what women, or at least what Princess Anne wants in this context, is actually to be empowered by being treated as an equal, not to be put on a pedestal, or not to be considered to be an object of perfection, but rather to be seen as a human being, as someone that doesn't always wear glossy, shiny jewelry and fancy dresses and that sort of thing, but does like to eat gelato out of a cone on the streets of the Rome outside the Colosseum and that sort of thing. So I think it is a really interesting commentary on power itself. So it's an interesting one to start off with, because I suppose in one sense it's not actually about loving a woman in power. It's actually about empowering a woman that only seemingly has power, that has power on a superficial level in one sense. Or at least it's opening the door to a question or a point of discussion, which we're definitely going to address as today's conversation moves forward, which is that power isn't static, that perhaps it's transferable, that perhaps someone might be powerful in one context but not another, and that we don't really have these fixed categories of power in the modern world. Something to think about for the next couple of minutes. But at this point, I'd like to move on to a film where it's pretty clear that the female character does have a great deal of power, or at least in the context of her relationship, or at least the relationship that we're going to discuss in today's show, is clearly the powerful one. And at this point, I'd like to move on to Claire Denis' film from 1988, and that would be Chocolat. Now, I must profess up front, and regular listeners to the show would know that my French accent is horrible. And this one is going to be tough to endure through if you are a native speaker of Francais, because all the characters here, except for, I suppose, the main one, France, the main character, or the little girl in this film, is actually literally named France. So clearly there's some symbolic or allegorical value to this one, but that they all have very French names. So you just have to bear with me on this one. But if you haven't seen this one, it's sort of a semi-autobiographical tale, I believe, that Claire Denis is telling, which goes over the story of a French family that lives in colonial Cameroon. And so we, as I mentioned, we have France, who is the little girl, and she has a mother, Amy, and they have a house servant who is a Cameroonian national, and his name is Proté. So clearly, with the main character's name being France, there is a bit of an allegory for colonialism, or that the film serves as a bit of an allegory for colonialism. And I think the film can be analysed in that sense, and has been analysed in that way a couple of times. But for the purpose of today's discussion, I think it might be interesting to actually take the idea of colonialism and import it into the romantic relationship that we're going to discuss. So what happens is, because France's father, i.e. Amy's husband, is out on business. I think he's like a ranger or some government official. He's out a lot of the time. Amy starts to, I mean, she's a very complex character. I mean, it's very hot in Cameroon. She's French. She's not native to the area. You know, she's very uncomfortable, I suppose, in the climate in a way. She doesn't really have any friends there. She gets increasingly frustrated with a lot of the local people there, which is, you know, sometimes not really very fair and that sort of thing. So she's becoming increasingly irritated with her circumstances. So, I mean, to say that she's out and out a powerful person in the film is actually, I think, a little bit of a problematic or superficial read of her character. But she does become increasingly fascinated in a romantic sense with Proté, who's quite good with her daughter and is a sort of like a member of the family. He's kind of, he's part of the furniture in a way. They're quite familiar with who he is. And I suppose it's a relationship that's built around familiar. There's a familial relationship throughout the most part of this film. But he is quite young. He's quite good looking. He's an attractive, pretty well-built guy. So you can see why she starts to find him quite attractive. So we start to get this parallel here between the colonization that's taking place in the country at large, but also the colonization of Proté himself. And so that's sort of getting at this idea, it's sort of evoking this idea that love, or at least lust or romantic desire, can have a sort of colonial spirit to it. And even when, you know, very often when we talk about power imbalances and that sort of thing, we'd usually assume that it's the woman who is the victim of that, or the subordinate in this situation. It's quite the opposite. So where we see Amy is sort of the one that has more of the power. Or does she? I suppose it's how you define power in a way. But we're seeing love as this colonial force. And we see Proté almost like this object of her affection. And I think it's very fitting that the film is called Chocolat, or if you don't speak French, that actually means chocolate. And just the way that that's explored as an idea, the idea of chocolate in this film, it's such a beautiful metaphor for what's going on. Obviously, you know, this opening scene evokes a lot of that milky brownness. We see France as she's grown up. She goes to this beach. I think it's on the southern part of Cameroon, on the coast there. I, by the way, you watch this film, you want to go on holiday to Cameroon immediately. It just looks so gorgeous. It's very similar. I talk a lot about Eric Rohmer's films on this show. And I got to say that this is almost like the African version of it in a lot of ways. You've got a lot of those chirping insects and, you know, those hot summery afternoons and having a refreshing swim in the ocean, that sort of thing. That's how this film opens. And we see this light, or it's sort of somewhere between, you know, a moderately brown beach. And there's this great shot where some of the characters that are lying on the beach are holding some of the water in their hands. And because of what the light is doing in this shot, the water looks almost like chocolate milk. We've got these beautiful images to start off the film. But Proté, as he is, as he's approached by Amy, he is almost like chocolate to her. You know, she sort of sees him in a way as this sort of seductive or yet forbidden object. A personal indulgence in a way. Almost like in the Lasse Hallström sense. You know, that in the Lasse Hallström film, chocolate is sort of this metaphor for indulgence or engaging in something a little bit naughty, but is nevertheless virtuous. You know, we're allowed to do that sort of thing. That's sort of her impression. She sort of feels like it's a bit of a taboo, but she's allowed to do it. There's this sense of entitlement to Proté, but nevertheless, it is an objectification of who he is. And if you read commentary of the film, one of the ways that it's put is that it's racial fetishism. So I think what happened, what are the most profound uses of this film is how it deals with racism in quite a refreshing way. Very often we talk about racism being an act of hatred, and I don't mean to say that it never is. Very often it is an act of hatred. But racism can also manifest itself in a way where it's not actually hatred, or at least the person that's engaging isn't being directly hateful towards the person. They could actually be fetishizing them, or at the very least seeing them as an object, an indulgence where there's a unilateral relationship where they indulge in seducing them, or they indulge in trying to consume them in a way. Foodifying him. I know that's not a real word, but I think it works for the purpose of today's show. Foodifying Protea, it's a really interesting way of depicting him. You know, it's something that she wants to consume. It's something that she feels should be nourished by. She has a positive relationship with the actions that she's performing, but nevertheless, it is consumption. He only exists as a subject that is relative to her. So this is quite a new way of understanding a power imbalance in a relationship. And the way that this relationship resolves, I think, is just so cinematically beautiful. I don't like to speak with too much exaggeration when I talk about films. I think that's sort of very often a way that people sort of dodge actually analyzing them in a substantial way. But I do remember sort of gasping when I watched this moment in the film. It's just so poetic. Eventually Protea is asked to go work out in the garage because, you know, Amy's embarrassed and she doesn't want him in the house anymore. And then France goes out to talk to him and ask how he's going, and he's sort of quite unenthusiastic about the whole thing now, and he sort of feels like he no longer sort of exists within the family circle anymore, and he just drops his spanner or his tool or hammer or whatever he's been working with in the garage, and he just walks out the door. It's the middle of the night, you've got the chirping cicadas or whatever insects there are in Cameroon, and he just disappears into the blackness, into the distant blackness. So while we've had all of these images of dark milky browns and then chocolate browns throughout the film, it's almost like, I don't want to get too racy here, but I don't want to get too racial here, but it's almost like he's disappearing into an utter blackness, that an inescapable blackness, or a place that is so distant from the colonial French culture or from Amy and France that they'll never be able to retrieve him. He'll eternally be out of their reach. And this idea of distance, the idea of never being able to find a distant place where justice or where things sit, where things can be found, the things that we desire can be found, is a motif throughout the film. France, at one point, France's dad talks to her about the idea of a horizon, because there's this plane that flies over a horizon. She says that it crashed. And he says, no, it's going into the horizon. A horizon is a place that we can see, but we can never travel to. You know, you'll never reach it. A very Jacques Derrida idea. No prizes for guessing what country he was from. With this idea of unattainability, that no matter how powerful you may be, if it's not reciprocated, if there isn't this perceived sense that you are in a relationship that is equal, where both people have a mutual respect for one another and a mutual love for one another, then you can't actually have love in its truest sense. So that's a very depressing one. And so far in today's conversation, we actually haven't talked about a relationship between a powerful woman where it's worked out, which is a little bit pessimistic, I suppose, especially because I'm sure there's a lot of women that listen to the show that are very powerful and have a lot of things going on and probably still want to think that love is within their grasp. Well, let's finish off with maybe a bit more of an optimistic film. And this would be the 1990 rom-com directed by Roger Michel. And that would, of course, be Notting Hill. Now, of course, this one does star Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts. And perhaps this is maybe their most famous film, or definitely it's a favorite of mine, I think, in terms of Hugh Grant. I think he just is that perfect kind of English, awkward, yet attractive kind of guy. But if you haven't seen the film, he lives in the humble Notting Hill in London, and he works in a tourism bookshop. Now, of course, I don't need to be the person to mention to you that obviously that he works in the holiday bookshop but never himself goes on a holiday. You know, the irony of that is quite self-evident. And one day, in walks a famous actor played by Julia Roberts, and her name is Anna. And they get going, and everything sort of is very romantic and funny, and you get the English wit versus the American humor throughout the film, and you know this was happening a lot during the time. Of course, you have Four Weddings and a Funeral as well with Andy McDowell and that sort of thing. But what I want to talk about in this film is how this relationship actually ends up working out, as opposed to the other ones that we've already mentioned today. And the first thing that I want to talk about as well, in the same way that we talked about in Roman Holiday, it's set in Rome. It gets back to this idea of the, you know, the origin of Western civilization, or the starting place. I mean, those sort of words, those sort of phrases are sort of speaking to the idea of temporality, of time, of duration. I think the idea of Notting Hill, you know, Roman Holiday has the word Rome in it, in its title. Notting Hill is called Notting Hill, I think, for a reason. It's set in a place that's a bit of a, I mean, we see a lot of images in the film of the markets, of the stalls that are in Notting Hill. So it's a bit of a meeting place, but it's a common place, right? So their relationship is actually born out of, or is nourished within, or grows out of this place that is a meeting point, a meeting place. It is just a place where all people of all walks of life can meet and stand on the same level. So obviously fertile grounds for relationship based on equality in a way. But of course, Anna is a famous Hollywood movie star. You know, she can't, Hugh Grant's character can't just pick up sticks and go live with her in Hollywood. There's a lot of difficulties. And we get to a point in the film, we're not really sure whether they're going to make it or not. And of course, there is a very famous exchange near the end of this film. And, you know, if you've seen the film, you won't be surprised at all by what it is. In fact, if you just Google Notting Hill quote, it's the first thing that comes up. It's very famous. But Anna is trying to profess her love for Hugh Grant's character, William. She comes to his bookstore and she stands there and says, you know, what about it? Do you want to come away with me? And he says, I live in Notting Hill. You live in Beverly Hills. Everyone in the world knows who you are. My mother has trouble remembering my name. And Anna replies, I'm also just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love her. Now, when I rewatched this film, I was like, how does it not just end there? It's one of the most, like, despite the fact of being a rom-com, it's one of those beautiful lines you'll ever hear in a film. But I think it's really important that he has to actually meditate on that and marinate with it. And he goes away and talks to his friends about it and actually repeats the line. It's almost just so that he's reciprocating this idea, or he actually has to let it sit within himself and acknowledge it himself. So ultimately, we're getting at this idea that, I guess, you can simultaneously be unequal with your partner in love, or at least with respect to their social status, or their social status within a given context. But ultimately, what we desire is to actually be reduced to our most basic, or most pure, or our most refined self, right? So ultimately, power is transferable, or at least it's contextual, right? So we get this idea that, yes, she is a movie star and he just lives in Notting Hill and works at a bookshop. But in the context of their relationship, they are equals. There is that mutual respect. So even though there are power imbalances in one area of life, be that Hollywood or book selling, when it comes to a sense of love for one another, a true sense of respect and a true sense of desire for each other, those propensities and the capacities that they have and the capabilities for mutual respect are in fact equal. So that's it for Sacred Cinema this week. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, on 2XXFM People Powered Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. If this is your first time, we would love to hear any feedback that you may have, be it positive or negative. You can find us on Facebook by searching Sacred Cinema with Jimmy Bernasconi. If you're a returning listener, if you're a regular, thank you so much for tuning in again. We would love to get some more recommendations for further films later on, and hopefully we'll see you again very soon.